Everybody has had an unforgettable day somewhere in your past. One of the things that was fun, when we had the big ice storm back in December and the electricity was out, we had, depending on when you counted, anywhere from 25 to 40 kids at our house for that week. And it was a blast. We had kids sleeping everywhere. We had them all. I mean, it was so much fun. But one of the things you do in a group like that is you start telling stories. I mean, this is a memorable time, a memorable place. You know, where were you when the lights went out, that kind of thing. And so we just started telling stories. And different kids were telling things that had happened in their life, unforgettable moments. The story I'm about to tell you is the one that stopped it all. Once this kid told this story, nobody else had the nerve or courage to tell their story. This was it. In fact, I'm about to tell you one of the most powerful stories I've ever heard. In fact, it was the kind of story that when he told it, when Brian told it, and it happened to him, I couldn't stay in the room. The embarrassment just absolutely flooded from my toes to the top of my head. An unforgettable day. Brian's story is pretty simple. It's something to this effect, that Brian said he didn't necessarily have the most luck with girls, and so the youth minister set him up for a date. He set up with a date for a girl that he's not dated before, and he's trying to think, what's a good safe place for somebody who doesn't think they're all that adept with girls? What do you do? Where could you get in the least amount of trouble? And the answer was, he went to a movie. That's pretty harmless. He goes to the movie, and he said, I'm sure I was nervous. And he said, being nervous, I had to get up and go to the bathroom. And he said, you go to the bathroom, you come back, and he sat down. Now, what I'm about to tell may not be an Easter story, but it's just life, and everybody understands this. It's part of it. He sits down, and he realizes as he's sitting there, he had forgot to zip up his pants. Now, again, this has happened to everybody. It happens all the time. Well, he's trying to think, how do you do this with this girl beside you where she won't see what you're doing? And he thinks of a couple ways. One is you kind of stretch up with one hand and kind of, that sort of, and that was one way. The other way is you sort of just kind of slink down in your seat like you're in a recliner, kind of put your hands in your lap, and maybe you could pull that one off as far as getting it zipped up. He said he chose the latter one, and he said it wasn't a good choice. Because in the process of slinking down and to go ahead and zip up his pants, he didn't pay attention that the girl sitting in front of him had really, really long hair. Really, really long hair. Did I mention that the lady had really, really long hair who was sitting in front of him? He said, I knew I was in trouble when I was halfway and it wouldn't finish and it wouldn't go either direction, and he was caught. Brian said, I am dying thinking there's got to be a miracle. I mean, there has to be something that occurs. Jesus come back or something in the middle of this. And sure enough, the girl in front, she gets some feel that something's going on. And so she tosses her head and she's caught. Now, we could give the rest of the gory details, but it's by this, every guy has left the room. I already know that. I mean, diving under seats and under couches and things. You need to know how this story finishes up. It's your worst nightmare. It finishes up with the lights on, the movie stopped, and the manager bringing scissors out to cut the hair out of the zip. It is an incredibly unforgettable day. We are here to celebrate something incredibly different from that. The most significant, unforgettable day in human history is what we are about today. No day in history starts to rank even remotely close with the event that we celebrate today. This is not some quaint religious ceremony we're going through this morning. This is not just some feel-good kind of a soul spiritual concept. More significant than when men walked on the moon, more significant when the first pyramid was built, more significant than the signing of the Magna Carta, more significant than the founding of Rome, more significant than the shot heard around the world, more significant than anything that you could dream or imagine was the day that Jesus Christ came out of the tomb. It literally changed everything. We're going to look at that day. We're going to look at it out of a prelude text, actually. We've been in a study in the book of Matthew. We're at Matthew, the 26th chapter. Matthew 26 through 28 is our text today, but we're going to take a look at the 26th chapter. And out of even a prelude to that day, we're going to sort of even understate a little bit what takes place. Matthew 26, 26 to 32. There are two primary implications. There are two main significant impacts of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and we're going to talk about those. But I want to introduce it out of, verse 26. Matthew 26 occurs on Thursday night. Thursday night is when Jesus has his last supper with the disciples. On Friday, Jesus will be crucified, and on Sunday, he'll be raised. But I want you to hear this text, Matthew 26, verse 26. And while they were eating, Jesus took bread and gave thanks and broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take and eat, this is my body." Then he took the cup and gave thanks and offered it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus told them, "This very night you will all fall away on account of me, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." There are two extraordinary concepts in this text, but even before we get to those, I have to do a bit of an aside. Here's the aside. Is it true? Did this really happen? Did this supper really happen? Did the prediction really happen? Did Jesus, was he really crucified? Did Jesus really raise from the dead on that Sunday morning? You see, that really matters, because if those things are false, then whatever you may think of the implications of some kind of a group worship service, it's a charade, and it's a lie, and it's a damaging lie. No, this is a question about whether or not it's really true. I don't mean, is it morally true? Is it a moral lesson? Is it some kind of helpful theory? Is it some kind of appeal to the soul, to deeper things? All of that's irrelevant. I'm not asking if it's spiritually true. I want to know if it's really true. If it's really true, then the two implications mean something. If it didn't really happen, it means nothing. There are four facts we have to deal with on whether it's true. The four facts are basically this. Number one, we know that the tomb of a man who had been crucified was empty. That's the first fact you need to deal with. The tomb of a man who was crucified was empty. Mary and Martha and the other women went out to the tomb. Peter and John went out to the tomb. And that fact, that they found an empty tomb, starts everything. His body wasn't there. Now, you need to remember that this occurred in the middle of range line as far as what life is concerned for those people. It occurred right in the middle of Main Street. This didn't happen in a corner. Somebody didn't come from some remote province and say, "Hey, we've got a story to tell you." This happened in the middle of the great ceremony, and the crucifixion was right outside the city gates. It was an execution of great enormity. And he is put inside a tomb, and the disciples, they ran at the crucifixion. They ran because they knew there would be more crosses for them. The Pharisees were very, very concerned that the legend of his resurrection would ruin everything. The religious leaders were afraid of that. So therefore, what they did was they posted guards on it. And a tomb that's guarded turns out to be empty. Some say they went to the wrong tomb. That doesn't make sense. All you have to do when this legend gets started is produce the body. Then fine, go to the right tomb. Never happened. History clearly records the tomb is empty. Some say the body was stolen. Really? There are guards there and a 2,000-pound rock, and I don't think the women were that scary. And this took place in the sight of everyone. There's a second fact you have to deal with. Not only was the tomb empty, but the eyewitnesses of that empty tomb also saw the resurrected Jesus. The eyewitnesses saw the resurrected Jesus. Jesus 15 times will show himself to individuals. Over 500 people in one crowd. And he will tell you of the two that walked with him about 8 miles headed west. He will tell you about his conversation with Mary. He will tell you the conversation with Peter. He will tell you the conversation, and you start down through the process. If they are lying, it is the most absurd lie that you could possibly imagine, because they give their lives for the lie. They went to their death confessing the significant truth that Jesus Christ is risen, and that issue is the central fact out of their eyewitness account. 10 of the 11 disciples will die as martyrs. The early church will never waver from this single story. We saw the risen Christ. Now some will say, well, of course you saw him. It was some elaborate trick. He never was really dead. One woman wrote a professor at a college and said her preacher was teaching that Christ probably didn't die on the cross. Her preacher was preaching that he probably swooned, and he probably came back and they saw the swooned Christ. And I like what the professor wrote back to her. Well, I don't do this literally. He wrote, "Dear sister, here's what you should do. Begin by beating your preacher with a leather whip that's embedded with rocks and glass, and beat him until his insides begin to fall to the outside. Then nail him to a cross, and then hang him in the sun all day. Run a spear into his lungs and his heart, and afterwards tell him to convince professional killers that he actually died. Wrap him in 100 pounds of spices. Put the spices in his mouth and his ears and his nose. Wrap him tightly in the spices, for that was the custom. Lay him in a rock slab in a tomb for 3 days without food or water or medical aid. And 3 days later, ask him to move a 2,000-pound stone and fight off professional soldiers and convince people repeatedly that he conquered death and they should put their trust in him. When your preacher has done that, he has dealt with the facts adequately. The third reason, I believe, that you have to deal with these as facts is we know that when people saw him, the resurrected Christ, their lives were transformed. Peter, how do you explain the change of Peter? How do you explain the mouse becoming a lion? How do you explain that? How do you explain Peter and John, who stand in front of the Sanhedrin? They would run before the crosses, but when the Sanhedrin beats them and says, you got to stop, their answer is, you do whatever you have to. We can only tell you what we've seen and heard. An unchangeable testimony. How do you explain the disciples? Disciples that have no particular skills, no particular background, and they're relentless evangelists. How do you explain that? How do you explain James, the Lord's half-brother, a skeptic, didn't believe, but the resurrection changed everything, and he himself becomes a leader in the church? Or Saul of Tarsus? There's a fourth fact you have to deal with, and that's pretty simple. The church explodes in the landscape. Within 50 days, again, something that occurs right in the middle of Main Street, within 50 days, 3,000 people say, I want to follow that Christ. With the next day, there's thousands more. The next day, thousands more. The next day, thousands more. Within one generation, the Church of Jesus Christ is scattered across. You do not have that kind of explosion without that kind of truth. Some people may never believe in Jesus Christ, but it won't be because of facts. Truthfully, it takes more faith to believe he didn't raise from the dead than to believe the eyewitness accounts that he did. But some people don't want to discover this truth the same way a thief doesn't want to discover a police officer, because there are implications in that discovery. The stories of Frank Morrison and Lee Strobel, men who said, I don't believe it, but I'm going to study it, and I will write, and I will prove. And Frank Morrison and Lee Strobel end up saying the same thing everybody else said. My Lord and my God. My Lord and my God. That most significant day did occur. What are the implications? What's it mean? I want to mention just a couple of things this morning. The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ mean a couple of things. Here's the first one. The first one means that Jesus is sovereign. He's Lord. He has full mastery. This world is his, everything. When he calls this shot the way he calls it and does it, he demonstrates his identity and his sovereignty. Just that little passage that we read in Matthew 26. Jesus takes bread and basically breaks it and says, now, you know, in a few hours, this is going to be what happens to me. He takes the cup and he pours and he says, you need to know in just a few hours, this is going to be my blood shed, this new covenant, forgiveness for many. He will say to them, you will all fall away on account of me. You're going to fulfill what Zechariah said 500 years ago. The shepherd's going to be struck down and the sheep will all scatter. Peter says, oh, that won't happen to me. And he says, Peter, it's going to happen to you too. In fact, you'll deny me three times before the rooster crows. He's already said in the text, Judas, you'll be the one who betrays me. Judas, it'll be you who does it. And then he says this, but when I'm raised, I'll meet you in Galilee. That's an incredible concept. This is a little phrase, I'll meet you in Galilee. You all recognize the absurdity of what I'm about to say, but if a meteorite were to hit me this week, and you have my funeral here, there is no doubt the absurdity of something if I were to say it this way. Now, after my funeral, after you've all kind of gathered and said whatever nice things you could create or invent or whatever you came up with, after my funeral, meet me at Doug and Drenda's. That's my brother. I'll meet you at Doug and Drenda's. And lo and behold, that is really what Jesus said in this text. Jesus said, after my body is broken, after my blood is shed, after you've denied me, after you betrayed me, after they have done all the things that Zechariah and Psalm 22 said, after all the Old Testament things are fulfilled, meet me in Galilee. I'll be there. The sovereignty of God, an incredible sovereign. I don't know when Peter really changed. I believe the resurrection absolutely changed, but even the knowledge Jesus had of when that rooster crowed, something had to happen to Peter. The sovereign God calls the shots. He predicted and dictated everything that's going to take place. Nothing in this text is a surprise. There's no sense of Jesus going, well, I'll be. Wonder how this is going to turn out. The sovereign God writes the entire path. John chapter 10, verses 17 and 18. Jesus said, I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me. I lay it down of my own accord, and I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it up again. I read this text, incredibly detailed conversation over the days ahead. He's sovereign. In John 13, verse 19, Jesus said, I am telling you this now before it takes place, that when it takes place, you may believe that I am. That's an interesting phrase. Do you remember what Jesus or what God said at the burning bush? When Moses said, who are you? And the answer is, it is the definitive name that God says, I am. And Jesus said, I've told you all these things ahead of time so that you might know that I am. The concept of who Jesus is and his sovereignty is established in this. That's why there's no great mystery then at the end of your book, if you've got your book of Matthew open in Matthew 28. Well, it's the most natural thing in the world then. When he says, verse 18, then Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Teach them to obey everything I've commanded you, and surely I'm with you to the very ends of the age. And nobody even blinks on that because of his sovereignty. He's right. Remember that silly commercial that was done with Larry Bird, I think, or Magic Johnson, I don't remember who it was, and done along with Michael Jordan. That call your shot before it happens. Off the backboard, off the wall, off the ceiling, off the light, and into this. Off the building, over the taxi, onto the road, and in this. It's a stupid little commercial. Because that's not possible. And I read this, and I would say the same. If he's not sovereign. I need to say this. You need to hear this. If he's sovereign, and this day established that, and you're not living as if you have a sovereign Lord, someone who has made a claim in your life that you respond to. If you do not live as if you have a sovereign Lord, then everything else you do is hypocritical. And everything else you do is an absolute intellectual insult. On assemblies where we'll sing songs of who He is, but you do not live as if He's your Lord, He doesn't have full claim over your life, the way you speak, the way you think, the way you invest your life, the way you spend your money, the way you handle your sex life, the way you handle your hopes and dreams, if they don't line up under the Lordship of Jesus Christ, then everything else we do is just a charade. Sovereign Lord. This is an aside, and I'll make them nervous on an aside because that's never written in my sermon, and it's not. But let me tell you what captivated me this week a little bit. This week I was looking at the text, different text, and I realized that the concept in Scripture is incredibly clear on this issue. Jesus has His cross, and He has His resurrection. And then He extends an open invitation, whosoever will may come. In My sovereignty, I will this. If you'll want to come, if you'll come to your cross, I'll give you a resurrection. You come to the cross with Me, I'll give you a resurrection. But you have to have your own cross as well, and you come with Me. You got to die to yourself. You got to die to your own agenda. You have to die to the values of this world. You have to die to everything that's sort of instinctive within you. And you've got to submit and come to Me by way of the cross, to the way of the resurrection. You want to know why the culture looks like it does in our Christian culture? The answer is everybody wants the resurrection and the glory. Everybody says, "Me too, Jesus. I'll show up at the resurrection. When my tomb gets filled, come resurrect me. Please give me the glory." The problem is, Jesus in His sovereignty already said this: without your cross, without coming to death yourself, you can't add a new life to an old life that didn't die. So therefore, when I say, "Jesus, I believe Your sovereignty," His appeal back to me is, "Randy, if you believe I'm sovereign and I can resurrect you, Randy, will you follow Me to the cross as well?" Anybody in this room, if you have not died to this world, then His sovereignty is bad news. Because His sovereignty means I must submit. There's a second meaning of this text. And by the way, it's what finishes the picture. See, if God were sovereign, but He were not merciful, we'd all be in trouble. And the second observation in this text is Jesus is merciful. I like just a simple little verse, verse 31, we read it earlier, where Jesus said, "You'll all fall away because of Me this night. You're all going to abandon Me. You're all going to forsake Me." Now, I would expect many of us would have a different reaction, but here's what His reaction is. And then verse 32, "I'll meet you in Galilee. I'll meet you in Galilee." The concept in there is pretty simple. Can you imagine walking down the street with a friend of yours and somebody jumps out and begins to mug your friend and you run for your life? You don't help your friend. You don't come back and do anything. You just run for your life. The next day, you see your friend walking down the street, stitches, beat up, bruised, battered. What response do you expect from that friend that you just abandoned and just ran from? And the most amazing one out of Jesus is, "This is My blood poured out for the forgiveness of many." Here's this friend walking down the street who throws his arms around you and loves you regardless of abandonment. And that's what this text even shows. It's just a simple little snapshot. Jesus is merciful. It doesn't take much work to prove that we need mercy. 5 times this week, someone in my office has said something to this effect: "I am so ashamed." 5 times I've clearly heard it said, "I am so ashamed." The reality is we all know we need mercy because everybody has a guilty conscience. We know we have failed to live up to our own standards, let alone God's. We are sinners and our own hearts condemn us. In our most honest times, we know that the law written on our own hearts is just an echo of God's law. And therefore, we're more in trouble with God than we are with ourselves. And we need mercy. And I read this text, and I see forgiveness. Jesus knew with certainty his closest friends and followers deserted him, but he also made plans to restore them. He knew they would fail, but he made plans to forgive. Forgiveness is one of our greatest needs. Every doctor, I think, and every psychologist in this room would tell you that half the people who struggle in life, if they just had forgiveness, would change everything. And I read what happened that morning, and I read of the forgiveness of my God. Our consciences can nag us, torment, and condemn us, John Piper said. But only Jesus can forgive us. Somebody else said it this way. If man's greatest need had been information, God would have sent an educator. If man's greatest need had been technology, God would have sent a scientist. If man's greatest need had been money, he'd have sent an economist. If our greatest need had been pleasure, he'd sent an entertainer. But our greatest need was forgiveness. And Jesus Christ willingly lays down his life. And then invites ollie, ollie, out, sin free. Whosoever will. I got to go through scripture this week with an individual, just chapter after chapter, because they asked this question, can God really forgive me? And we just started back, and we took to the Psalms, and we just went through passage after passage. You know, scripture says there's two things God can't do. God can't lie, and he can't remember sins he's forgiven. A simple text about sin, and I will remember them no more. The cross of Jesus Christ is about the sovereignty of God and forgiveness. Anytime the gospel message is proclaimed, there's always three groups. There are always three groups. Always is. One group that will always be here in any situation are people who say, I will not. I will not. There are individuals who are so convinced that they would not want to be a Christian, that they could not imagine giving it up. And so in every crowd, there's somebody who says, I will not. I suspect even today, there's somebody sitting here going, this is a lot of religious garbage. And I'm here for a lot of reasons. Keeping peace in the family might be one of them. I don't know. But I will not. What are you going to do? What are you going to do with Jesus? I want to make an open invitation. I'd make an invitation to anybody here. If you'd like to study and look, if you'd like to study and take an honest look, I'd love to study with you. There are people we would love to sit down and look at this with you. This matters too much for you to blow it off as nothing. What do you do with historical evidence? What do you do with Jesus? We'd love to study with you. But you got to make sure. You got to make sure the reason you're not saying no to Jesus is not this central issue. That if I said yes, I'd have to give him control of my life. Willful stubbornness against your God is an unpardonable sin. There's a second group that'll be here. Anytime the gospel message ever preached, there's a second group. Wherever real Christianity is, there'll always be a crowd that gathers around it that's cultural. A crowd that culturally accepts the same thing. Same way Moses will go up on top of the mountain and meet with God. There'll be a golden calf syndrome. There'll be a crowd who gathers at the base of the mountain. There's a whole cultural concept that says, take Christianity and use it to your advantage. Use it. And so you never surrendered your life to Jesus Christ. All you did was step into a culture where Republicans and Democrats and Christians, and you go to elementary schools and junior highs and high schools, and you go to college, and it's all kind of wound together. If you are a cultural Christian, but you have never made Jesus Christ your Lord, his sovereignty and his mercy both cry out. Remember when Moses came and encountered the burning bush? And the voice of God was, take off your sandals, you're standing on holy ground. And Moses quickly did. I would say to you, those of you who are cultural Christians, do you not understand in front of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, you're standing on holy ground? The bush is on fire. What are you going to do with that? You can't keep living a life that looks like this world and be a follower of His. What are you going to do with that? There's a third group. A third group would be people who have various maturity, but they are people who say, "My Lord and my God, here is my life, and here's my gratitude." As the invitation hymn is sung this morning, some will be singing with gratitude, "Thank you, God." And a couple of other groups will be singing with a bit of rebellion. If you'd like your rebellious voice to change, you step out in this invitation hymn. There'll be elders, it'll be in the aisles, there'll be ministers down front. We'd like to talk to you about the risen Christ. Would you stand as we sing?